thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 105, recorded Thursday, April 17th, 2014. The Digital Spring.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the it's sort of spring edition of Digital Campus. This is actually Digital Campus number 105, which is every time the number gets bigger and bigger, I just marvel at the fact that we keep doing this and having fun while we're doing it. We'd be having more fun if the weather were better in parts of the Digital Campus universe. Dan, how's the weather in Boston?
Well, we had snow yesterday, but it has melted and it is a balmy 38 degrees for mid to late April. I'm still rather disappointed.
Yes, and Tom, just a little further south in Connecticut, any better weather report from there?
Yeah, a little further south, but a little further out in the country. We've got 35 here in stores, so.
Yeah, well,
that's all I can say.
As my younger son said when it started snowing here in Washington on Sunday night, after having been 70 degrees in the morning, he looked outside and he said, "Dad, the weather is just dumb." And that kind of sums it up for what the winter in the Midwest and the East Coast has been like. I can't speak to the West Coast because I have no friends out there, so I don't know how bad it's been. But it's certainly been dumb around here. Stephen Robertson is the fourth of our regulars joining us. Stephen, any better weather over there in Robinson Hall on the other side of campus, or is it just pretty much the same as what I'm seeing?
I remember I'm over here in Research One and looking out on the sun, so it looks good when you're inside at least.
Yeah, well, that's good. And if I had a window in my office, I would be enjoying it too. Not that I'm bitter or anything. Also joining us at the Center for History and New Media are two of our fabulous graduate students, Amanda Reagan and Amanda Morton. Thank you, Amandas, for helping us out today with the show. Feel free to chime in at any point. So as we look into the spring, we're confronted by a number of topics that seem pretty future-oriented. And the first of those is some new rumblings out of the federal government about automated record keeping. And this is really a big issue for historians because, as some people have called it, we're potentially entering into a digital dark age of record keeping because the record keeping systems, the archiving systems of the federal government, vast though they are, were really created to deal with paper, and so much of the business of the U.S. government is now done without paper, only in pixels. And there's been a great concern by historians that a lot of that information that needs to be archived is not being archived successfully. And 20 years from now, 30 years from now, historians are going to look back at this period and not be able to find much. Stephen, have you taken a look at this story at all and given any thought to what this means and what the proposals look like?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, it does start with that first premise that the Obama administration has said, you know, all records are going to be digital going forward. And in that sense, they're kind of, you know, they're sorting out what the playing field's going to look like. And they are confronting us with a future when everybody is going to have to deal with digital records for the government and not paper records. And in some ways, you know, that still remains useful to us, I think, in reminding everybody that working with things in digital form is the future for what we're doing, and is going to have to be part of what we do otherwise. But beyond that, there's that, you know, the lurking in this story is the thing that always gives people pause, the notion that the selection of what's going to be archived is going to be driven by an algorithm of some sort. And, you know, I always feel in two minds about it. On the one hand, the idea that this is going to somehow be automated raises all kinds of fears about what that's going to do and not do. And yet the other side of that is a sense that, that we haven't exactly been doing this in a more straightforwardly successful way before we turned it over to algorithms. So I think, you know, it's not a, oh my God, you know, we're losing control of the straightforward story. It's going to be like anything else we do digitally. It's going to be how well we do it with the algorithm and how well it works. And at least in some ways, it's potentially a slightly more transparent practice, assuming that they share it all with us. But you know, this is about the future, and the future is going to be straightforwardly digital. And I think this forces everybody to, you know, focus down on what this would be. But because it is in the future, I'm not sure that I know really what this is going to mean, other than that the future, as everybody, you know, in this group and listening to this is probably already comfortable with thinking about, is going to be digital.
Right. I mean, I think that the, you know, as with many things like this, the devil will be in the details of the implementation. You know, it's not at all clear how federal agencies are going to implement this. I'm almost positive it's going to vary greatly between federal agencies once it's in place. And that will confront a whole bunch of problems for historians looking to work with these records, that they'll have to, you know, learn different systems for different agencies to find different kinds of documents. And I think, you know, we're faced once again with, you know, what Roy Rosenzweig called the problem of abundance. I think we're going to end up with, you know, huge, vastly increased access to materials, but then it's the question of what does a historian do with those? And I fear that the kind of tools that we currently have are not adequate to the task. I mean, as much as I love Zotero, I don't think when faced with the entire electronic record of the federal government from, you know, the 2010s, you know, a reference management platform like Zotero is going to kind of do all the things it needs to do to make sense of that work. And so, you know, in some respects, it's going to keep us as digital humanists employed for the next many years to try to figure out, you know, what are the kinds of tools that people need to make sense of what is going to be just a sheer, you know, abundance of material.
Yeah, it makes me think about how we're teaching students going forward, because so many history students depend on government records as crucial sources for the work that they do as they begin to encounter historical research. And, you know, these vast collections that have been categorized through some kind of algorithmic process, we're going to have to get up to speed on that as educators, and so that we can teach students how that's done. I mean, we're probably, all of us who teach history or teach in the humanities, are reasonably good with the Library of Congress cataloging system, but this is a whole different animal. And, you know, I think teaching students to work with these kinds of algorithmic decision-making processes is going to be really important. And, you know, speaking just for myself, I've got a lot of learning to do before I can teach that effectively.
Yeah, it also seems like even understanding the data structures of some of these items is going to be really hard unless they're really explicitly spelled out. You know, I just think we're dealing with a real set of heterogeneous kinds of digital items, and you know, we'll need to make sure that there's really great documentation, because even trying to do some basic searches on this material might be incredibly hard. And, you know, I think we're talking here about a scale that goes well beyond the, you know, 40 million email from the Clinton White House, which now seems like a tiny number. I mean, I can only imagine what the scale is going to be in 10 or 20 years.
But I think in some ways that's the important thing here. This is, as Tom was saying, this makes it kind of keeps us in business. It removes any kind of ambivalence around the kind of projects that we've been talking about for a while. We do have to learn to deal with abundance. We do have to build, you know, new tools. We do need to actually interrogate this data in different kinds of ways. I think all of those things are, there's a lot of devil in these details, but if we take it one step further back, I think it's sending a really clear message about the fact that dealing with those details has to move further up the kind of agenda of what we do as scholars, and you know, the continuing battle to get sort of digital methods as a core part of what historians are taught. I think that this is one of you know, one of the things that can be powerfully deployed along those ways. In a few years, if you want to study the federal government, you're going to need us to be attuned to a range of digital issues that, you know, that we still, at this point, haven't sold to everybody out there as key parts of our toolkit.
Right, and I think, you know, Stephen, this moves it from, you know, this realm of, let's say, digital humanities, where, like, only, you know, the technology-savvy folks are doing this kind of stuff, really into the realm of, okay, everyone really needs to know these skills, right? It's not, we're not here talking about some advanced robotic cyber scholarship. It's, we're really dealing with just everyday knowledge that people will have to have.
Yeah, and that's really my point is that, you know, the historical methods class that we teach, I'm teaching it right now, you know, I'm not teaching students about data structures or information architecture, but really I should be. And that just needs to be part of the basic curriculum, not only for history majors, but I would say really for educated citizens, which is one of the things that we're in the business of doing, is producing educated citizens. And if we're not including some basic introduction to these kinds of issues like information architecture, I think we're really doing our students a disservice. So so that's one issue for the future. The second is kind of both looking forward and looking back simultaneously, and that is the recent announcement of the Open Syllabus Project. Dan, were you just kind of, I know you're on the, like, the advisory board for this, were you just glad to see the Syllabus Finder idea rear its head once again? You know, I really miss Syllabus Finder. I can't tell you how much I miss that. But
yeah,
so tell our listeners about the Open Syllabus Project and how it's different from the good old days of Syllabus Finder.
Right. Well, Syllabus Finder now is over a decade old, which it's hard to believe, although it did have a foreshortened life. And really came out of when Google came out with its API, which allowed anyone direct access to their giant web page database, their index. I wrote a little bit of crummy code that just pulled out syllabi from across the web, openly available syllabi, and teased out some metadata information about them. You know, the university or college the syllabus came from, the topic, things like that, and I stored that in a big database, and for a while I was caching the full text of those documents as well, about 100,000 of the documents, and then metadata for another million syllabi from about 2002 to 2009 when Google cut me off, as they did with everyone else using the API, because they didn't want people replicating Google's services across the web, and they wanted to start making money after their IPO. So Syllabus Finder died, and now it has risen like a phoenix in this project, the Open Syllabus Project. And I've gotten requests over the years to make use of this database that I accumulated. In fact, I think in 2011, I sort of released it more broadly, just made it available as an open download and told everyone to kind of have at it. But this seems like a very coordinated project now. What they've done is what I was hoping people would do for a long time, which is they've gone out and crawled the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine to replicate the full text for the remaining syllabi. I think they're up at around 800,000 full text syllabi now at this point. And, you know, I think what this represents is, Mills, something, you know, you've been looking at too, which is we can really start to approach the teaching of different topics in a more analytical fashion, understand what people are doing. I had written a kind of, what I like to think was a kind of suggestive article with the Syllabus Finder in 2006, I believe, where I looked at the teaching of American history and found that it was very highly textbook-based and, you know, a lot less creative than I think people had been portraying the, you know, U.S. History 101 classes. And also found some interesting things there about the kinds of additional books that professors tend to assign in those classes. For instance, there's a very high level of using novels and other books in the African-American experience because of the feeling that the textbooks did not provide adequate coverage even in 2006 of those topics. So So I think it, you know, provides a way for others to kind of come in and look at all kinds of things, not just history. I mean, there was sciences, arts, humanities, social sciences, all are represented in this giant corpus. And I think the Open Syllabus project is also trying to now accession more recent syllabi. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. But I'm hopeful that this will be an important research corpus for everyone to use. And it is good to see it revived in this way.
But if I understand correctly, I can't go to the corpus and just pull out an individual syllabus and look at it. Is that right?
Right now, you can't do that. And, you know, I think there's also some not copyright concerns per se, because most of these places, I think at Mason, it's the same way. You have to post your syllabus online. And after all, Google and the Internet Archive are caching these things as well, and you can go there. So we're just providing, in a sense, a filter to find just the syllabi. But we don't, you know, and it'll be interesting to see what these folks do. I think they're based at Columbia. But there's no way right now to just go in and grab a particular syllabus. Although if you know what you're doing, you can get all the metadata for it, including the original link, and then find it that way as well.
Yeah. I do think this raises, at least as far as, well, both in my sort of own experience here on campus, but also if you read the comments on some of the comment threads on some of the articles about this announcement, it does raise some controversy, I think that the leaders of the project are responding to that by not making these syllabi, you know, kind of easily grabbable from their site. That faculty members have a tremendous sense of ownership over their syllabi, and I think a lot of people are and are going to be unhappy about a project like this grabbing them.
You know what's hilarious about this, Tom? And I feel this too, and having taught for many years, I feel this, but the number one users of Syllabus Finder were other professors.
Yeah, right. Well, that sense of ownership is kind of absurd. I mean, I actually, you know, I'm now on in one of these curriculum committees, and I've noticed that a lot of professors actually like claim copyright over their syllabi. They like put a copyright thing in there, which is you know, questionable to begin with. But I mean, just the impulse to do that suggests that you know, they people feel this tremendous sense of ownership. What's been cool about this is it's actually sparked a conversation here at UConn among the digital humanities folks about you know, sort of pushing a movement to get all of UConn's syllabi not just into this archive, but available publicly online through the UConn website. So I think in addition to being an interesting project and something and a great resource, it's also, I think, moving the conversation forward. You know, it's my personal view that as a state institution, like, you know, our syllabi here at UConn should be available to the citizenry. But I do think it's you know, both an interesting project in itself, but also a way to kind of move that conversation about open access to educational resources, and in the case of state universities, state resources forward. So that's cool.
And on the you know, the state university faculty, I'm sorry to say, don't have a leg to stand on when they try to claim copyright, because that's already been handled in the courts. It's been, I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
Eight or nine years ago, it's
work for hire.
It's work made for hire. And so the product of your research is your intellectual product, and your teaching is work made for hire, and your syllabus is part of that. And so if you're a state employee anywhere in the United States, then your syllabus is not your intellectual property that you can copyright. It's just the courts have already ruled on it. And so unless somebody wants to challenge one of the decisions to the Supreme Court, right, that's the law of the land. And so, they can't claim copyright. It just doesn't actually mean anything when they do it.
I think one of the uncomfortable truths is that, you know, the reason that the number one users were other professors is there was already a lot of very heavy cribbing from other syllabi. And if you look through the database at the full text, you know, what you would see is a kind of platonic ideal of U.S. History 101, mm-hmm. which you know, most professors would vary by 10 to 20%, but I don't mean to discount this. There were absolutely professors who were doing very unusual, very creative things. We know a lot of them. I'm not saying that everyone is doing this, but I think for a lot of classes, particularly introductory classes and those that use textbooks, which, you know, after all is, the majority of classes are these kinds of classes. They're not advanced seminars in your specific area of research. And there is a lot of convergence there. And I think it's okay to confront that fact and to see what is going on in those kinds of courses and to understand that exists. And I think we're all strapped for time, and I don't think maybe there's anything necessarily bad about going to a service like Syllabus Finder and seeing, hey, how have other people taught this topic? What are the kinds of primary and secondary sources they're using? And to borrow from that. I think, you know, if we can get past our embarrassment, I think that's, you know, that's perfectly understandable.
And I think that picture that you've just described is the most important thing in some ways we can get out of this, a sense of really what the patterns and how we teach are, that there isn't an enormous amount of variation here, that there isn't in some ways a lot that's so distinctive that you'd want to protect it if you, you know, actually somehow thought that you could through copyright. But I think there is sometimes a sense out there of what is going on in syllabi that isn't grounded in anything like the kind of data that a project like this is actually going to offer, and that Dan wrote about when he did write about the way that textbooks were used. And I think that, if anything, it forces people to confront that question, you know, one way or another. What exactly is different about doing a survey course with a certain professor in a certain institution with certain kinds of resources? This is a tool that actually lets us have that discussion in a much more informed kind of way. And you know, it can work both ways. I mean, if really, you know, it forces people to think about what's at stake in the kind of platonic ideal that everybody's slipped towards, and recognize that, you know, the claims of certain people to be doing distinctive things can actually be assessed in one way or another. So I think it's kind of striking that we haven't had, especially, you know, apart from the moment in the Sun that Syllabus Finder had, we haven't had a capacity to really get this kind of macro picture. And I think that that it's going to be enormously important. You know, the concern remains how much of this stuff is now, you know, locked down in various ways that we can't access. And so that doing this kind of thing going forward for places that aren't posting syllabus online, that are locked in Blackboard or somewhere else and are being shaped by that, you know, how we get that information. But if we could ever do that, I think it would be also interesting to see just how the LMS has changed the way that people think about their syllabi and design their syllabi, as another variable that goes into this. So, you know, the conversations that we can have about our teaching with a tool like this, I think, are way overdue and really important going forward.
Yeah, and I think, first of all, I the convergence doesn't bother me that much, because there will always be people who, you know, in IBM, in the old days, IBM used to talk about having the, you know, they had that sort of button-down culture at IBM with the blue suits and the white shirts and all of that, but they also like to let some wild ducks roam around in the building, and that's how they got new and really exciting ideas. And there will always be that in higher education, despite whatever kind of convergence goes on, just because academics tend to be pretty independently minded. But, you know, in other industries, convergence is also called best practices. And so I'm not troubled by us finding out what looks like best practice in certain kinds of standard courses, like an introductory history survey. I think it's plural. There's not a best practice. I think there are best practices. And so having this kind of data available to look at that convergence around what seems to be working well, I think is really interesting. Stephen raised the point about the, you know, not being able to see the things that are locked up in learning management systems. And that leads really then to our next topic, which is Blackboard, which some people like to call the Borg of education software, because resistance is futile. They have acquired a number of open source software systems and small companies and things like that recently, and this has generated a lot of chatter in the ed tech community. Tom, what do you think about Blackboard moving into more aggressively into the open source space? Does this bother you? Does it make you happy?
I am sort of ambivalent, and the reason is because I'm, you know, in general, like, I as much as I appreciate an open source competitor to Blackboard in Moodle and Sakai, you know, I actually think that the whole concept of a learning management system is flawed. And so, you know, having a flawed open source option, I guess, is better than having a flawed commercial option. But, you know, in both cases, I would encourage institutions to, you know, not rely so heavily on these kinds of systems, or as heavily as they have come to. So in that respect, I'm sort of ambivalent. But, you know, is it going to change the landscape for people looking to implement learning management systems? I don't know. I mean, it depends, I guess, what Blackboard wants to do with this. If they see these two companies who provide, you know, services around open source software, you know, which is a very kind of common business model in the open source world. You know, you think of Red Hat for Linux, for instance, where they provide a flavor of an open source product and then they support that flavor, in the marketplace for a fee. You know, I think that's what Blackboard is going to be doing, with Moodle. It depends what they do. If they continue to provide the same service that's being provided by these companies, which is what they're saying they're going to do, then maybe it expands the market for the open source option. It sort of Blackboard Salesforce can go out there and sort of sell both products and get, you know, possibly switch some institutions to the open source platform. The worry, though, is that those salespeople, you know, present the two options and say, yeah, but our commercial product is better, and that ultimately is the more expensive product. Or they kill off the open source service altogether at some point because it's, you know, for whatever reason. So I think, you know, some of this will play out over time. I'm just not sure how much it really changes the overall landscape in terms of educational technology, because it doesn't offer something new, something different outside of the kind of standard learning management system model.
Yeah, I thought one of the things that was interesting in the news about it was the statement by Blackboard that they expected that the money that they make from their kind of core learning management system products is going to decline. Well, it's going to decline as a share of their total revenue, very substantially. And so they're really trying to diversify what they do in terms of, you know, and they see that some of these open source businesses provide the opportunity for selling services around those open source products, which is different from their, you know, pay us a subscription to use the learning management system.
License.
So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I'm with you. I don't use a learning management system. I've never been a fan. I don't think it's useful for students because when they graduate from college, they'll never use that system again unless they, like, go to work in a college cafeteria that uses a Blackboard, you know, point of sale system. But I don't think it's really helpful for them. I think it's more helpful for them to try to develop their own capacities with technology. But at the same time, I understand the kind of administrative shorthand that these systems provide when you have a lot of contingent faculty members who just need to be able to plug into an existing system and use it and then unplug from it when they move on. And the fact is we're in a model right now where an awful lot of teaching is done by contingent faculty. And so it does provide some kind of consistency for students, and that's not all bad. But yeah, I'm with you. I think we're going to have to wait and see what the future holds on this one. Also in the future, our good friends at Udacity, Udacity for some of you, but I persist in calling it Udacity because I just think it's a better marketing name.
If they had taken our advice, Mills, early on, then they wouldn't be where we are.
They could have had their own hip hop song. And, you know, this is of course not news to anybody who's been following what Audrey Waters has been writing about the ed tech industry, because, you know, Audrey tends to be a couple of steps ahead of us on most things like this. But the folks at Udacity have decided that they're going to start charging people to get certificates for completing a MOOC. And so it's, yes, you can still do the MOOC for free, but you can't actually get some kind of a credential out of it without now paying. I think it's $150. And so the question, I had two questions about that. One is, will anybody actually do that? Because the universities that have tried to sell MOOC courses for credit have seen this turn into a spectacular failure where like one student or no students actually sign up to pay for credit through a MOOC. And two, it's, you know, people may, I think, do this. Some people may do it, but all the research on MOOC participants and MOOC completion shows that the people who are completing are people who already have bachelor's degrees by and large. And so, you know, if I'm working in the tech industry and I need a certificate that shows I can, I've taken a basic course in how to program in Python, well, I'm, you know, okay, I might pay $150 for that. But for the average person, I don't see it. Also, it leads me to question, are they having trouble with their financing that now they have to start charging for this? What do you guys think? Is this going to work?
It was just inevitable that their venture capitalists would ask them to start making revenue. I mean, start making money. It's just amazing how quickly, I mean, if you just look at the headlines for MOOCs in 2012, 2013, and 2014, how quickly it has moved from this idealistic, like, bringing knowledge to the world and especially the you know, those with few privileges and no money and all that, to realizing, oh, this is actually the most advanced students and often students from wealthy countries that are actually using this stuff. And, oh, maybe we should now charge because we have to make money and this isn't really about open access to the best faculty in the world. I mean, it might be in part in that, and we haven't talked a whole lot about edX on this show, but, you know, I think certainly Coursera, by hiring Rick Levin, the former president of Yale, and making a big push into charging and to China, is sort of signaling what they're going to do there. And I think the same is true for Udacity, a.k.a. Udacity, that now it's 2014 and sort of everyone's getting down to business. And I think the story around MOOCs has really changed in, just drastically in the past couple of years.
Yeah. You know, I just kind of forgot that there was all this venture capital involved. And I forgot that venture capitalists like to make money.
I should have
remembered. I should have remembered. Now, I'm, of course, being facetious, I mean, this was, it was always a venture capital push in the first place. And I think that higher ed got, you know, all kinds of stars in their eyes. And, you know, just down the road from us, some folks got really big stars in their eyes. And that led to all sorts of upheaval on their campus. So another... another, you know, chink knocked out of the narrative about MOOCs transforming the landscape of higher education. Oh well, I guess it's good I didn't invest.
Well, but maybe there's hope that we can get out of this narrative completely now. I mean, you know, as we've just laid it out, the MOOC, as you know, it was sold to us all, as Dan just described, is pretty much gone. And you know, at some point, it would be nice to shed the whole baggage of the term and what it carries with us, and actually get down to people talking about what this has become.
Totally agree.
And so that, you know, I'm waiting for that to be the next stage. When are we going to stop talking about MOOCs as they were sold to us and actually go back and look at what they've become? And I think, you know, there maybe we're at a little bit of the mercy of the, you know, a media sense that this is the label we're stuck with for this whole narrative. But, you know, maybe we need somebody like Audrey to, you know, really push harder to get people to reframe this discussion and say, okay, we've left all that behind. Let's stop talking in the terms of the story.
So Audrey, if you're listening, you know, I know you've been really holding back on criticizing these companies, but we're just giving you permission to let loose with both barrels.
Change the story.
Yeah, as though Audrey hasn't been letting loose with both barrels. Then I'm going to like try to pull a nugget out of this whole MOOC waste of time, and that is that I think in education there are certain things that are really hard for students to understand and really hard for faculty to teach. And, you know, I once asked a group of nursing faculty, what was the hardest thing to teach a student in anatomy and physiology? And they said that they all said the same thing. It was five of them. They all said the same thing, which was the pressure system in the heart, the sort of complex mechanism of keeping blood pressure correct through all these various valves and arteries and everything else. It's really hard to grasp and it's really hard to teach. And so I think that there are people out there who are really good at teaching some really complicated and difficult things. And what we need is the 10 minutes or the 15 minute example, demonstration, explanation by people who really can do it. And then, you know, if I had something that I just can't figure out how to teach, I could grab that and through edX or some other place and pull it into my class and say, okay, folks, watch this. And this person who really can do something that I can't do can explain it to my students or show them how to do it or walk them through a demonstration, and my students can all say, oh, okay, now I get it. And I think that kind of, you know, and that's sort of mookish in the sense that it's like the same sort of technological platform. That, I think, has real value. But who knows whether that'll happen or not.
Well, and people are employing that. I mean, that sort of exists, you know, in the wider world of the web. Like, if you want to know how to, like, I don't know, like, change the handles on the faucet of your bathtub, like, you can go to YouTube and there are, like, 10-minute videos. Like, here's how you do it. And so, and people use those things all the time. So there is a model for that, and it's being used. It's just, you know, it's not something necessarily that higher ed has explored.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't have lifted the backseat of my car if it weren't for you. Something fell behind the backseat. I couldn't get it up, and the owner's manual was completely worthless. But there was a YouTube video I just typed in, lifting the backseat in a 2010 Prius, and first video, there it was, and how to do it. And it took me then 30 seconds to lift the backseat, but the owner's manual was never going to show me how to do it.
You know, and I suppose that was the original vision behind the Khan Academy videos, which that project has, I think, moved in somewhat of a different direction. But, I mean, I think those early videos were, you know, sort of short, concept kind of based videos, like here's how to do one thing well.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll see more of that. Turning to our last sort of future point for today, and that is that we have a birthday coming up, and it's not one of your Digital Campus hosts, but instead it is the Digital Public Library of America. Dan, tell us about the first birthday. What's it going to be?
Well, we are very excited to have reached a first birthday and to exist, to continue to exist. It's been a busy first year. We launched on Paul Revere's ride, anniversary of Paul Revere's ride on April 18th, 2013. We're recording this on the 17th of April, 2014. So tomorrow will be our first birthday, and we're really excited that the collection has actually tripled over the last year. We're at more than 7 million items, and we've gone from 500 contributing institutions to almost 1,300, and we have materials in over 400 languages now, which is something I just found out this week, which strikes me as amazing, because America's collections, of course, include materials from around the world, and with many languages, both indigenous and from all the people who have immigrated to the United States. So it's great to be here a year later and to have it thriving. And we've got some big announcements that are coming out later today about some new major partners that will be joining us and donating their collections, including the Getty, major museum that I'm sure everyone knows, based in LA.
That's great. Wow.
Yeah,
great.
Really terrific. And in fact, the Government Printing Office is joining as an official partner of the DPLA. So some of what we were talking about earlier, hopefully DPLA can index this stuff and provide new pathways in. And I think that's one of the things that we've really been trying to do over the last year is to, the same way as I think many projects from the Center for History and New Media, we're trying to provide innovative interfaces and pathways into these collections that really take advantage of digital technology so that researchers of all kinds, students, teachers, advanced researchers, professors, the general public can find whatever they're looking for in these collections, whether it's browsing by map or timeline or by faceted search or through the API through using one of our apps that third-party developers have made. So it's a good time to check out dp.la. Got the shortest URL around, so hope everyone takes a look.
Yeah, well, thanks, and thanks for leading this project. I mean, it's just I know my students this semester have really been making extensive use of it, and it's just really, you know, I'm really excited about it, and I know, or at least I have some sense for how much work has been required to make that huge jump from, how many did you say you started with?
We started with a little over 2 million, and we're now over 7 million, and this was a lot of this was done on a kind of artisanal fashion using our network model where we have what we call service hubs in different states. And so, for instance, our service hub in Minnesota goes out and has gone to over 150 small places. I mean, some of them really mom-and-pop historical societies in rural Minnesota to help them scan and put their stuff online. So I think, certainly for historians interested in American history, we are surfacing a lot of really rare and unique materials. So I think it's very complementary to some of the big collections that are out there. We hope to expand, triple again, hopefully, in the next few years and make some additional progress.
Well, that's great. And hopefully your head won't explode during that process. So
I hope that as well.
Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to my co-hosts here, and thanks to the Amandas for shepherding us through this. And we will talk to everyone soon on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you.